Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 10th, 2025, and our friend Graham Fuller is back with us. Welcome back, Graham.
Thank you, Nima.
Graham, let's get started with what is going on between the United States and Iran, which is somehow is so dangerous what's going on. And on the other hand, we've been witnessing that the Trump administration is talking about on Saturday, they're going to have Trump says direct talks, Iran says indirect talks, but whatever that would be, it is somehow shows some sort of hope for us.
Yeah, I think, you know, we both know that Trump likes to use both stick and carrot in getting involved in negotiations. So I think at this point, Iran is probably more open to negotiations than it has been for a while. We know that it has been weakened by the collapse of the Syrian regime, by the end of Hamas, and Hezbollah, both very heavily weakened. So I think its weak bargaining position may be weaker than before. But I think, you know, we both know Iran's extreme national sensitivity and pride that I think will not allow it to be bullied, and it has said that very clearly in its public statements. So I'm very heartened at the direct indirect talks. That's major progress. The other thing that I think is very encouraging about it is that obviously this took Bibi Netanyahu by great surprise. This is the second time now that Trump has sprung new ideas, new things on Bibi Netanyahu that I think has upset Netanyahu. The first, of course, was simply Trump's announcement out of the blue that America would take over Gaza, which, of course, is supposedly part of Israel's territory. And then secondly, this announcement that he would go into negotiations, which is exactly what Netanyahu did not want to hear. I have the sense that maybe Trump welcomed Bibi's arrival, or maybe even brought about Bibi's arrival to say this to his face. And on top of that, having Bibi coming directly to Washington protects Trump in some ways from some of the more extreme Zionist groups who, it's not like Trump is turning him down. He brought him in for those very discussions. So I think there are some interesting things going on here.
David, how do you see the situation between the United States and Iran right now? Are you optimistic about Donald Trump finding a solution, or maybe trying to negotiate with Iran, understanding the other party, or you see the threat of war, a direct war?
Again, the military buildup that the U.S. has been undertaking is very worrying, again, because that points to war, obviously, and a problem with the military buildup, even if you do it just as a bargaining chip, it somewhat commits you publicly and makes it much more difficult to back down. And it does create a kind of an inertia in favor of war that can often lead directly to war. I'm very afraid of that. Even if that wasn't Trump's original intention, that could very well be the outcome. I think that what you're seeing here is the long-term effects. Again, I got in late, so I'm not quite sure about the background that Graham Fuller may have already given you, but you have the JCPOA negotiated by the Obama administration. In my view, one of the relatively few, but nevertheless noteworthy positives of Obama's foreign policy was the JCPOA, which did offer the prospect of ending the likelihood of war with Iran, the basis for war with Iran, and moving towards full normalization with Iran, which is where we should be going. That was torn up by Donald Trump in his first term. And now we're seeing the long-term effects of it, that he now has an excuse, basically, to saber-rattle with regard to Iran. It seemed that the main objection that Trump had, if I understood correctly, in tearing up the JCPOA was uranium enrichment. In other words, Iran agreed not to become an actual nuclear power, but remain what's called a threshold nuclear power, meaning that they had much of the infrastructure to enable them to move in a few months towards nuclear weapons if they chose to do so. It seemed that was the objection. Trump wanted not only to block their access to nuclear weapons, but to block access to being a threshold nuclear power. This came, it's a level of almost demanding that's at face value unreasonable, because after all, the US itself developed nuclear weapons. They were the first country to use nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons, everyone knows that. But for some reason, it's a matter of outrage if Iran even has the capability to develop nuclear weapons. And it seemed that this was very close to almost demanding Iran self-abase and accept humiliation. And it wasn't good enough that it wasn't just going to forswear the need for nuclear weapons, but Trump wanted them to go further. Netanyahu clearly wanted them to go further. It almost seemed like there was a pretext for war going on here. And so I'm fearful that the United States has gotten itself on a treadmill whereby it will accept nothing but the absolute self-abasement of the Iranian government. And if that doesn't work, the U.S. is openly threatening war. This is extremely dangerous, and nobody would come out of this very well, including even Israel, if the U.S. actually does go to war with Iran.
Graham, what does Netanyahu want from Donald Trump and his administration that Donald Trump is capable of delivering that to them?
To Iran?
To Israel.
To Israel. If I were an Israeli leader, particularly Netanyahu, I would not have a great deal of confidence in Trump in general. I mean, Trump makes all the right noises and hugs Bibi and all that kind of thing. But I'm not sure that Trump has any particular love for Israel in the way that perhaps Biden in his own disjointed way maybe had. Secondly, Trump is very mercurial, unpredictable. Bibi has now seen that personally in the White House twice. And I think he has no confidence as to where the United States is going to take its Iran policy, especially given Trump's frequent remarks in the past during the campaign that he wanted to bring a peaceful settlement to the Iranian problem. So basically, for Iran, Iran wants to be the complete hegemon of the entire region and wants Iran to be reduced to nothing. And not destroyed physically, but to becoming a meaningless small player, say something like Syria. That's just not going to happen. And I think Iran that Israel is seriously underestimating the emotional power that Iran can exert both domestically and abroad on this particular issue. Just thinking back, you know, this almost reminds me of the lead up to the overthrow of the Iranian prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, in 1953 by a coup led by the British and with CIA tagging along. That also was accompanied by all kinds of threats and sanctions against Iran by the British. The British were trying to maintain its total domination of the Iranian oil business. And it was unacceptable to Britain. So I think the Iranians have been there before. They've had to face down and suffer the consequences of invasion, coups, everything else. And you can see that in their language right now, that they're not going to accept being bullied. Now, they have to accept what some of the realities are. And as I said at the outset, the realities are now that Iran has lost a lot of its potential capabilities, but it is still probably the most important country in the Middle East, at least politically speaking. And any kind of conflict, I think, would be quite catastrophic to the region. So I don't think Bibi knows really what he wants, except that he wants Israeli domination of the region. And he's simply not going to get it, at least in terms of Iran. And I think that Israel is gradually losing its credibility and moral authority, if it ever had any, in the region, and that cannot help, plus his own internal opposition.
David, do you have some point to add to what Graham said? Or
well, there's beyond what he's, you know, the specifics he made, I would add just one more point, which is the ideology of neoconservatism, which was very much dominant to the foreign policy establishment. Trump himself seems to have had some skepticism of this ideology, but a lot of the people backing him, notably Waltz, the National Security Advisor, and Rubio, do seem to have leaned at some degree in that direction. And seem to be, for the moment at least, driving the policy. Netanyahu clearly is very much intertwined in this ideology. And one of the key points of the neoconservative ideology, and I studied it carefully from the 1970s onward when it began, is two things. One of them is uncompromising U.S. power, all right, without any challengers, basically unipolarity, all right? There should be no challenger to American unipolarity. And the neoconservatives find it frustrating that you have countries like Iran and China and Russia that do not simply bow down to U.S. dictates, and the whole idea is crushing them. That's one of the reasons we have a war in Ukraine right now. They insist that the way you deal with a country like Iran is simply to crush it militarily. Military force, not negotiations, is what solves problems. That's very integral to their ideology. Another part of their ideology is admiration for the state of Israel, that Israel shows the way of what America should be like. They see Israel as a country that relies upon offensive military action and decisive victory. Now, that's idealization of Israel. Morality aside, Israel's military is not always that efficient and does not always achieve decisive victory. It doesn't always get victory at all. But they idealize, I think the neoconservatives idealize Israel as this hyper-efficient offensive force. Perhaps ironically, they don't say this, but I think ironically, it's a little bit like, you know, Germany overrunning France or something like that. And that's an ironic, deeply ironic and disturbing analogy, but it's almost a little bit like that, very offensively oriented. And the neoconservatives like that. They like the idea of the United States looking to Israel as the model of what we should do. Unapologetic use of force. Israel never apologizes for using force. And it's integral to the way the neocons think. So it's quite natural the neoconservatives would want to act in concert with the government of Israel, because they see United States and Israel having virtually identical interests that are almost indistinguishable from one another. And so I think that's another variable here, is an ideological component to what's going on with Iran. Iran is the principal impediment, virtually the only major impediment in the Middle East in terms of states, not in terms of organizations like, say, Hezbollah or Hamas, which is not really a state, but the only state-level opposition to Israeli dominance in the region.
If I could just add though on that too, I fully agree with David. It's appalling the degree to which the neocons at least seek to identify with Israel. And it's interesting the pushback from John Mearsheimer on this issue, who says that Israel is not an asset to the United States, it's an albatross around the U.S. neck. But I think there's another factor that may be creeping up in here. It's been in the background for a while, and that is the role of Turkey. Turkey for a long time in gentler ways perhaps, but has been outspokenly sympathetic to essentially nonviolent Islamist movements, especially the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, as we know, Israel and Turkey came to blows some years back when Turkey tried to send aid to the Palestinians by sea in the Mavi Marmara flotilla that Israel shot out of the water, which created a lot of bad blood. But I think increasingly Turkey is feeling its oats. It's feeling that it has, that there is almost no other power in the region willing to stand up for the Iranians, for the Palestinians, except for Iran itself. So, and now with Turkey very deeply involved in Syria and a Sunni government, supposedly Islamist Sunni government in Syria, I think the possibilities of Turkey coming into greater friction and even military confrontation in Syria cannot be removed at all. and especially if President Erdogan in Turkey feels that he could also use a kind of conflict like that to strengthen his own electoral standing in years, in the months to come.
The point, David, the point that Graham mentioned, he literally is of concern for Netanyahu. We know that in that meeting, they were talking about Turkey, or Turkey as well. How, what is the main concern on the part of Netanyahu? What do they want to do with Turkey? And which would be, of course, the United States would be able to do for them, for Israel.
Turkey historically has been a country that, under the sort of the Kemalist ideology that now is in, not so much in favor in Turkey, they'd seen themselves increasingly as detached from the Middle East, a secularist, you know, majority Islamic country, but nevertheless highly secular, modern. That was, I think, the conception they had, whatever that term modern means. And consistent with that, they always had business-like relations with Israel for a long time. They were the only Middle Eastern Muslim country that had full diplomatic relations with Israel at the ambassadorial level. That's changed since the Camp David Accords. But so they always had a relatively positive relationship with Israel. They were a NATO member, of course, allied with Israel's main backer, the United States. Under Erdogan, however, you are getting a different conception. First of all, it obviously is more turning towards away from the Kemalist idea towards Turkey's, the fact that Turkey is an Islamic country, and it's much more identifying with that at a cultural, to some extent, even political level. And you are also getting Turkey acting independently of NATO. They acted somewhat in concert with Israel and the United States, I assume, overthrowing the Assad government, which was an astonishing development. But now they've overthrown the Assad government and they no longer have a common enemy. There's a question of who will dominate in Syria and with what interest. And, you know, Erdogan cannot fully turn a blind eye from what Israel is doing to fellow Muslims in Gaza and in Lebanon. And also Israel's repeated bombings and violations of Syria's national sovereignty. And so there is always the possibility of Turkey increasing its intervention, particularly if there's a war with Iran. It would be very hard for Turkey to completely stand aside from that. And so I think the whole idea here is for Israel to find some means of keeping Turkey simply out of these conflicts as much as possible, as unlikely as Turkey is to stay out of it. I don't see how Turkey can fully disengage from what Israel is doing.
Yeah. Graham, do you agree with what David said about Turkey and the way that they're seeing Israel attack in Syria?
Yeah, Turkey has a bigger stake now, not simply, as David pointed out, a shared hostility to the Assad regime in later years, but it is now a stake, it as a positive presence in Syria. I would expect Turkey would wish to contribute to the rebuilding of Syria, would attempt to try to keep Syria within some kind of framework of Turkish interests. And I think it's fairly well poised to do that kind of thing. So yeah, I think the old Turkey is, as many people have pointed out, the old Turkey is absolutely gone. Good NATO ally, loyal ally of the West, blah, blah, blah. That's gone, and Turkey is now almost a sui generis, unique nation in its own right, with its own geopolitical visions are extraordinary. I mean, Turkey says, we're a Mediterranean power, we're an Islamic power, we're a Central Asian power, because Central Asia is primarily Turkic in its population ethnicity, and we're involved in Northern Africa quite deeply, and even in other parts of Africa, Turkey, and very much in the whole Eurasian effort. So this Europe is almost an afterthought in Turkey's interest in some ways. Turkey will never want to break with Europe, nor will it want to absolutely break with Washington. That's too useful to have it. But Turkey is not under anybody's control except their own.
David, when in the case of Iran, we are witnessing again, Secretary of State of the United States, Marco Rubio, is not in charge of what's going on. It's Steve Witkoff again. Mm-hmm. With the ceasefire between Palestinians and Israelis, with the case of Ukraine, and right now, this is the third case on the part of Witkoff to participate in. How do you see Witkoff so far? Are you optimistic about what he's going to achieve?
I'm not clear because he's gone back and forth in this. He's the one who brokered, originally demanded, really, kind of somewhat harshly, that Netanyahu agree to the ceasefire. One first phase and second phase ceasefire. Then after the first phase, Netanyahu said he's going to simply violate the ceasefire and not go to the second phase. And Witkoff said that's just fine. And so he seems to go back and forth as Trump seems to go back and forth. As far as I can tell, Witkoff reflects Trump's viewpoint. That's one of the reasons that Trump uses Witkoff. He doesn't really have an independent political base, unlike Marco Rubio, who is a prominent senator and a presidential candidate, at one point a political rival to Trump. And so, you know, Rubio obviously has some authority of his own. Witkoff does not have any authority of his own. And I think that's why Trump likes to use him. He does seem like he's somewhat capable, but his background entirely, if I'm not mistaken, is entirely in real estate. I don't think he has any diplomatic experience at all. I'm not sure if he speaks any foreign languages. I very seriously doubt he speaks any of the relevant languages in the Middle East. And so he doesn't really have any background information that one would expect and might be helpful in a situation like this. He has a kind of toughness that one develops in the very tough real estate business. I'm not sure that really transfers well to the international relations realm. One of the things we're seeing with Trump, which is very interesting, is a repudiation of expertise and expert opinion. That Trump himself is a testament to that. That's, he had no qualifications, obviously, when he was elected president in 2016. That's one of the reasons he was popular. I mean, I understand the psychology behind this, which is that expert opinion has gone very badly. Expert opinion brought us the war on terror, which was a disaster. It brought us the overthrow of Gaddafi, which was a disaster. It previously brought us the Vietnam War, which was a disaster. They had so many disasters. It brought us the deregulation of finance, the 2008 financial blowout. And I think the public has gotten wise to these factors. Oh, during the COVID pandemic, and had all sorts of mistakes that were made by expert opinion. The claim that there was no lab leak, that it was the wet market in China, and all of those things. So expert opinion has not always lived up to its billing. And as a result, the public seems to want something else, non-expert opinion. And it was exemplified by Donald Trump and his sidekick, Witkoff, as the expression of that. And as much as I understand the skepticism people have of expert opinion, given all these failures, you do need some degree of expertise in something like, let's say, dealing with Iran. You do need to know some of the historical background. And that doesn't seem to be present here. I assume the people in the State Department and the CIA were advising them, but I doubt Trump listens to them very carefully. And there's a tendency to throw out the baby with the bathwater. The screw-ups by the foreign policy establishment, which were profound and deep, doesn't mean you can simply rely on somebody who has no background knowledge to do the power brokering here, but that's what's happening. I think that's one of the reasons you're getting these oscillations of policy. I think it also reflects Donald Trump himself, his temperament, which is he's not a very disciplined person. He doesn't seem to have any real consistent ideology as far as I can tell. He doesn't claim to have an ideology, he's a deal maker, which means he switches from one thing to the other. And so it's very hard to predict where he's going to go with this. I assume whatever Witkoff does will be what Donald Trump tells him to do. And when Donald Trump changes his mind, Witkoff will change his mind. My only hope, basically, is the changing of mind is in favor of de-escalation, which is possible. Because again, Trump oscillates between two different positions. One, he's openly said he's kind of a peace candidate, he's a man of peace. He's repeatedly said that. He ran against people like Liz Cheney, not just the Democrats, but Liz Cheney. She's a war hawk, a radical war hawk. He repeatedly condemned her for that. On the other hand, he's himself the arch tough guy. He likes to show how tough he is. And so he oscillates back and forth between a man of peace and a man of war. And who knows where he's going to go with this? That's the best I can make of it. I don't know, Graham, do you have any better predictions than that?
No, I mean, I share, David, it's almost impossible to predict much of anything with Trump's mercurial personality, although in some odd ways that mercurial personality might be useful in keeping opponents off balance, both foreign and domestic. But I would just come in with a little bit more possible optimistic reading of Witkoff. I was fascinated by watching a couple of interviews with him. And yes, the guy has no expertise at all, but David, you yourself skewered, you know, 50 years of American foreign policy run by so-called experts. I don't have a lot of faith in experts. You may know a hell of a lot about a certain subject, but it doesn't mean you're going to do smart things. I get the feeling that this guy is street savvy, for whatever that's worth. I think I sense that he's good at getting the feel for the person sitting opposite him. I assume that he's obviously very intelligent. I assume he would soak up briefings offered to him by the State Department or CIA on 10 things you should know about dealing with Iran. But I think he has this kind of feel for people that and an understanding that you've got to be, you can't be all, you know, hostile and confrontational in the way that all of Biden's team was totally confrontational in dealing with China. They were supposedly the guys who had had some foreign policy background. And you remember when Blinken and his sidekick went off to, where was it, in Reykjavik or some northern place to meet the Chinese, and they basically lectured the Chinese that we demand that you do X, Y. They had not any feel for what the Chinese were feeling, and they got back a real lecture in their face and saying, we will not tolerate being addressed by you in that manner. That is not negotiation. Well, I don't think Witkoff is going to make that kind of mistake. And I don't even think Trump would, perhaps, always, because the art of the deal does mean having some tiny sense of what the other are doing. But I'm trying to put the best face on it as I can. These are uncharted waters.
David, we know that Witkoff, with the case of Ukraine, at least from what we've learned from him, from his interviews, he was trying to do everything. But do you see the case of Ukraine coming to an end, or the case of Ukraine is going to be continued as the talks with Iran, as the situation in the Middle East is just going on and on?
I'm somewhat more optimistic about Ukraine and somewhat more willing to make predictions about what Trump's going to do in Ukraine than I am on the Middle East, because it seems to me that Trump had an unrealistic expectation of some sort of, he'd impose a ceasefire by diktat, I guess, and that Russia would simply accept the ceasefire, it doesn't seem to take into account that Russia, it was not in Russia's interest to do a ceasefire without a comprehensive settlement. What Russia wanted and said they wanted was a comprehensive settlement, including not just of Ukraine, but of the whole security architecture of Europe. They've been insistent on that from the beginning. And they would be, from their standpoint, just looking at their interests, they'd be foolish to accept a ceasefire without a comprehensive settlement for the simple reason they are winning on the battlefield. And they have no interest in letting Ukraine or the United States take a breather and rearm and retrain its troops or something like that, and then restart the war in 30 days on more advantageous terms, which is, of course, what they wanted to avoid. And so quite naturally, they refused this agreement. And so the war is continuing right now. I don't think there's a clear path by Trump for a peaceful settlement that I'm aware of. Who knows what they're doing in private? I mean, that's unknown to me. But at least insofar as the public record that I'm aware of, there's nothing in the offing immediately that suggests a path to a diplomatic settlement. The good news is I don't see Trump escalating this, and I don't see him going back to Congress for another aid package. That seems improbable to me. He said nothing of the sort that he would do that. I don't think Congress would be in the mood to approve another aid package. And inevitably, what that would mean, almost certainly, would be that Russia will launch an offensive. By some indications, they're already starting to launch a new offensive. And they'll start winning on the battlefield, and they'll either take what they want and impose a peace at the point of a gun, which would be not a good outcome, but they probably will be in a position to do that if that's what it comes to. Or after a few months, Trump will realize the folly of his ways and the fact that Russia is going to have the upper hand here, no matter what the United States does. And the U.S. is going to have to settle for a peace agreement that will reflect the fact that Russia holds the upper hand in military terms. Again, all of this is deeply tragic because all of this, there's no doubt in my mind, this could have been prevented by diplomacy, particularly an agreement that involved an ironclad guarantee of neutrality, eternal neutrality for Ukraine and no NATO. And it could have been settled within the first months of the war. It almost was settled at Istanbul, but the U.S. blocked it and Britain blocked it. The record on this is absolutely clear cut and unambiguous. There's no way to deny it. And even Jens Stoltenberg, the outgoing, the previous Secretary General of NATO, said in passing a sort of a Freudian slip, he admitted that the move to admit Ukraine to NATO was why Russia invaded, which raises the question, begs the question of why on earth did they ever propose admitting Ukraine to NATO? That was a foolhardy idea. But in any case, that did happen. We did have the war. Here it is. And the only way to settle this now is to acknowledge the fact that Russia has the upper hand militarily and that a peace agreement of any sort, even one that favors Russia, is better than a simple victory on the battlefield. And if Trump hasn't figured that out yet, which appears to be the case, I suspect he probably will figure it out in short order. Again, the good news, I'm definitely not a fan of Trump and their enormous problems with the man, including the tariff war he recently launched, which was very destructive. But one positive of him in comparison with Harris and Biden, as I suspect had Harris been reelected, I would be very fearful she would have been sort of a dead ender and would have been determined to continue the war at any cost, no matter what the cost, because we were so deeply engaged in it. The foreign policy establishment was just so insistent on gaining a victory, even if that was impossible. She would become something of a dead ender, and there would be a very high risk of escalation to the point of nuclear war. I think that would indeed have been a risk had Harris been the presidency. I don't think Trump is intending to go there. I don't think that's a significant risk with Trump. So that is a good thing.
Nima, if I could just add it here, I agree with everything David says. The one thing that really still does disturb me quite a lot is the potentially destructive role of Europe. Europe has been cast aside, I think rightfully so. I don't think Europe has been any meaningful foreign policy ever since the end of World War II. And it has been the huge economic benefactor of U.S. presence in Europe, enabling the Europeans not to have to spend money on their own defense anymore. But I think if we look at especially the role of the UK, which is highly destructive, and I've become more and more aware of this just in recent years, if you look back into history, the destructive role in the imperial mindset of the UK still is there. They haven't forgotten their greatness of empire, and they see the US as the instrument by which they can perpetuate this greatness in the shadow of the U.S. power. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Britain, especially Britain, goes out of its way to sabotage in any way it can these talks with between Trump and the Russians. And indeed, the British have been quite outspoken, at least the House of Lords, in a document some months back, saying that a Trump election would be deeply damaging to European, to UK dominance and power in the region, and that the loss of that very special relationship would cost the UK dearly. This was quite explicit in this House of Lords document. So if they may well try to trip up Trump, remove him in some way or other, that is my single greatest fear about where this whole Ukraine thing may go in the months ahead.
David, Graham mentioned the case of the United Kingdom. You have the ego, you have the body. Do you think that the ego is fitting the body, or they're just having some sort of fantasy about how they're capable of influencing the United States foreign policy, considering Ukraine?
I think, you know, Graham's clearly right that the UK embodied now with Prime Minister Starmer, but the whole British establishment seems to be, or most of it, seems to be following this idea of British imperial greatness. You'd think after Suez they would have figured out that that's no longer the case, but they seem to be almost having a pre-Suez mentality here, that it's still the days of the Raj or something, and they still have this enormous capability that they obviously don't have. In reality, we have here is an island off the coast of France. It's really not that big a country. It's the number of troops you could field, I don't know, 10,000, 20,000 maybe, combat forces with heavy equipment. It doesn't really have much of an army. I mean, it has nuclear weapons. It has a seat at the UN Security Council. It has a glorious past, or what they see as a glorious past, I suppose. But that's about it. I mean, they don't really have that much military or economic muscle or diplomatic muscle at this point. The whole of Europe really is not what it used to be. And so I would see it as more just bluster and ego. I'm sure they'll try and throw some monkey wrench into the machinery, as the saying goes. I don't know how effective that would be at this point, because I just don't know how many levers of power they really have, which is a good thing. Because again, if you read speeches by Starmer or speeches previously by any of his predecessors, especially Boris Johnson, these are detached from reality. He's proposing things that don't have the slightest chance of actually playing out. And if they did play it out, well, God help us, I suppose. But fortunately, he doesn't have the capability to do anything like what he's claiming he wants to do. And it's amazing how obsessed they are. The British economy is in terrible shape. And partly because of the Ukraine war, not there are other reasons too, but the Ukraine war has made it worse. The cutoff of energy to the European continent has affected Britain, the increased price of food, all of those things. And it seems that Starmer is obsessed basically with winning the war against Russia, defeating Russia. You think he'd have more important things on his mind at this time, but there we are. I should add, one of the reasons I think he might be doing this is because he's deeply unpopular. As Macron is unpopular, as Merz, the incoming, Merz isn't even Chancellor of Germany yet. He's already deeply unpopular. This is really fueling a very toxic political atmosphere in Europe. I mean, it hasn't really been noticed, but as of last couple of days, the biggest party in Germany is the far-right AfD, which is considered a toxic party, and I think rightly so. And the European establishment has no one to blame but themselves for the rise of the AfD and for comparable groups all over Europe, because they're so obsessed with this absurdity of defeating Russia.
Yeah, just one quick point on that, Nima. I agree with David entirely. But David was talking about Britain's military capabilities. I'm talking more about what he referred to as throwing a monkey wrench into the works, and going back again to the whole overthrow, joint British CIA overthrow of Mossadegh, who was really, you can arguably, one of the first third world or global South leaders to stand up to British imperialism, and paid for it very dearly by being overthrown by Western powers. I could easily imagine Britain, possibly even in cooperation, God forbid, with the Israelis, in some kind of, I don't know what it would be, some kind of destructive operation that would trigger some kind of a crisis, which could potentially lead to war, and especially against Iran. I'm sure the British have not. If the Iranians have never forgotten the role of the British have never forgotten what happened to them in Iran as well. So that's far from over, especially if the Israelis are involved in it.
We had, David, we had an article. It was a long article, like a chapter in a book, yeah, in New York Times, about how deeply the United States is involved and was involved and has been involved in the conflict in Ukraine. And do you think these people who are just trying to put out this article and blaming everything on Zelensky and his commanders for the failure in Ukraine, do you think these people are giving up on the conflict in Ukraine, or they're trying to do everything at their disposal to make some sort of obstacles, barriers for Donald Trump to achieve something?
I think they're trying to do both. I thought the New York Times article, to me, it didn't really reveal very much that we didn't already know, as far as I could tell. Maybe in some details, but the broad picture was already well known based on other evidence. It was written, it was an insider job, like so much of the New York Times reporting on foreign affairs, especially covert operations. It was written like a public relations advertisement for the intelligence services, especially the CIA, to some extent the uniformed military, actually very much the uniformed military. They cited people like Cavoli and all the other generals as being almost heroic, larger than life figures, geniuses of strategy and so on, the modern day von Clausewitzes of our time. Perhaps they didn't say that, but that was almost the tone. And that the Russians were these bumbling idiots. Everything they did was stupid. Everything they did was a screw up. They never did anything right. I'm sure that's all true, no doubt about it. It's it was just a public relations exercise. I can't believe the New York Times prints these things and presents them as serious journalism. That's what I find mind blowing. But in any case, the in terms of a political agenda beyond simply promoting people who basically wrote the article, I think the New York Times journalist here was almost a stenographer. I think if the agenda was setting up a blame game when Ukraine loses the war, if they lose the war, as undoubtedly they're going to lose the war, who is to be blamed here? Well, clearly not the American generals who were, as I said, geniuses. I did everything they possibly could. Certainly the Russians are to blame. There's never any doubt about that. But also the Ukrainians, as heroic as they were, they're to blame because they didn't do everything the Americans, in their extraordinary wisdom, proposed they do. They, at key points, they screwed up. Some of what they were saying was wildly implausible. I mean, the 2023 offensive, when it was launched, it could have been won. We could have pushed the Russians out of Crimea, but the Ukrainians just didn't do what the Americans said to the letter. What this ignored is the whole premise of the offensive didn't make any sense. If anybody who studies war knows that to undertake a ground offensive like this, you need overwhelming ground superiority, usually at least 3-1, preferably 5-1 superiority in personnel and equipment. The Ukrainians never had that. They didn't come even close to having that. And so I remember when they were planning this, I was thinking, anybody who knows the history of warfare knows this is a very strange operation. I can't imagine how they're going to win. That was never dealt with in the article. Basically, it seemed to me, to the extent that there's a gambit here, it's to glorify the U.S. role, maybe a little bit. Some have said, I've seen this in antiwar.com, is a little bit trying to set it up as almost lost cause. In the American South, there was the idea that it was a noble effort by General Lee and his generals, who were also geniuses, but it was a lost cause. But we should celebrate their genius and the glory of what they tried to do. In the South, there's still some of this kind of thing going on. And it seemed almost there was a tone of that. I was hearing Strains of Gone with the Wind in the background while I was reading this article. I'm getting a little bit caricature here, but it's very easy to caricature this article because it was such a bad article.
The only thing I would just add to that, David, it really does represent, for the first time, an acknowledgement by the New York Times indirectly that they've lost the war.
Yeah.
That's quite right. A step.
Yeah, that's true. That's an innovation.
Yeah. Graham, in Europe, they're talking about Macron being the representative in the talks with Russia. If they need to participate in that sort of talks. But when you look at Macron and his role, since the conflict started, he wanted to negotiate, talk with Putin. Then he turned and he became the worst enemy of Russia, more radical as time went by during the conflict. And he wanted to send troops to Ukraine. He wanted to build nuclear bombs. And he says that by 2030, we have to fight with Russia. This guy is changing his mind, his rhetoric, every other day. And why is he, do they really believe that he's going to be important? He's going to have an important role in the talks with Russia? Or they just want to sabotage the talks with Russia?
That's a great question, Nima. I don't have any good answer for that. I would say that Macron simply because of who he is and what France is and the role of France for good, both bad and good over history between those two countries. France has to figure in any settlement with Russia in Europe. And in that sense, I think I would probably almost rather have Macron having the leading voice in Europe than, say, Stoltz, who I don't think has any particular skills or brain power in diplomacy at all. And I don't know who else would be, and God forbid that the British would be involved in that. So of those three, I guess I would prefer Macron to having the greater voice. And I think in the end, as long as the gloire of La France is maintained in some way or other by perhaps the importance of its role, then I think France could play a constructive role in all of this. Also, there's the interesting side aspect. I mean, it's an ugly issue, but with Germany talking about rearming now and spending all kinds of money, I don't think it's realistic at all. So I doubt that the German public is going to want to spend all that money. But I can't believe that the Europeans may just have some tiny little misgivings about a powerful German rearmament program. I don't want to blame the Germans. There were Syria; they weren't necessarily responsible for World War I, but there are historical memories, and small countries like the Netherlands or Belgium or others may not be terribly eager to join in a big rearmament program led by Germany.
David, right now there is an economic war between the United States and China, and we see China differently right now. Look at China, what it was in Donald Trump's first term, and they tried to compromise, cooperate with the United States. And right now it seems that they're perceiving that Donald Trump is not in the same mood, or maybe China right now is much more confident and comparing to what it was in Donald Trump's first term. They're more confident because of Ukraine, because of what has happened in the Middle East, because of the economy of China, which is so much important right now in terms of the global economy. Where does this confidence come from when it comes to China? Because they said they're going to fight the United States till the end.
The confidence on the part of Trump or on the part of the Chinese leadership?
On the part of Chinese.
Well, as you said, one of the things that's been very useful to China in terms of its geostrategic position, ironically, has been the war in Ukraine. Basically, this has discredited American power. The United States went into this with an enormous amount of hubris and incompetence. And again, you know, we were talking about the failures of the establishment. I mean, Tony Blinken is an emblem for that, the failures of the establishment, the incompetence of the establishment, the utter mediocrity of the establishment. He exemplifies it. And his signature issue, of course, was starting a war in Ukraine. I do see him very much as starting it. And one of the things he was trying to do, I have no doubt, is to fire a shot across the bow to the Chinese. If we can defeat Russia and reduce it to vassal status, which I assume what he wanted to do, this is what we can do to the Chinese. The Chinese would take wind of that. Other countries would take notice of that. And it would reinforce American unilateral power. It's had the opposite effect, of course. Nothing, there's the phrase, nothing succeeds like success, nothing fails like failure. The U.S. policy in Ukraine towards Russia has been a failure. And so it's quite natural the U.S. is going to take a major blow in terms of its prestige internationally. And China, which had leaned, as we all know, in favor of the Russians, is on the winning side. It never hurts to be on the winning side of a major conflict, which is exactly what the Chinese have done. The Chinese have not been Israel's backer. The United States has been Israel's backer, so the United States will pay a very heavy price for that too. All of this, of course, has accelerated American decline, and accelerated. I don't think so much it's moving towards China in China's favor of in terms of Chinese setting up a new, you know, moving from the American century to the Chinese century. I don't think that's what's going on. I think it's more of a multipolar century, if you want to call it that. I use the term century. That'll be multipolar in character, with the Chinese maybe as first among equals, but I think the BRICS are going to become a major pole of power. This inevitably would have happened anyway, because I think the U.S. power was on the decline, and China was on the ascent. But the wars, the various wars, and the disastrous U.S. role in these wars have, so to speak, put its foot on the accelerator of all of these processes and greatly sped up the process. And so China will certainly come out of this more powerful than before. John Mearsheimer, again, is somebody I very much respect and admire at many levels, and mostly I agree with him. But I think he's mistaken to see China as a kind of aggressive state, somewhat like a
yes.
United States. And one of the things to look at is the military budget, China's military budget. China's economy is roughly the size of the United States. By the purchasing power parity measure, it's larger than the U.S. And its military budget is about half of that of the United States, it could have a bigger military budget than the United States does easily. And if it really had these kinds of ambitions of military dominance, that's what China would be doing. And it's not doing that. It is increasing its military force, but nothing on the scale of what the U.S. has. And so that indicates to me what we're going towards here is not Chinese dominance, but multipolarity.
Graham, your take.
Yeah, I think the Chinese have been playing something of a different game all along on this, and a very skillful game. I think it was Deng Xiaoping in the past who suggested that China should not boast of its skills and its accomplishments, but should keep its accomplishments under a rug or under a bushel or something like that. In other words, don't provoke a excessive reaction out of the West or out of the United States by demonstrating our particular military or and economic skills. I think under Xi Jinping, there's been perhaps a greater willingness to show the lengths of Chinese power, but it's still been cautious. And I would argue that Chinese foreign policy essentially has been non-military, and on the contrary, it has really based its extending power in the realm of investment, building of infrastructure in the global south, and in essentially trying to provide aid to developing countries that really need it, and avoiding making it very difficult for Washington to beat the drums of saying, oh my God, the Chinese are coming, we've all got to get together. I think the American effort to try to beat the drum as it tried against Russia for years, and now against China, is probably not working terribly well. I'm not sure that the Japanese, the Indonesians, the Vietnamese and others are going to want to jump onto a bandwagon who's a grouping whose very purpose and raison d'être is to oppose China. That's just not smart. Even if you're worried about China, you don't want to build up an alternative bloc, and that's what the U.S. has been trying to do. So I think China's foreign policy has been much more skillful than ours. And for the United States, which is, it has a very broad cultural basis, economic cultural basis, yet it's seemingly its foreign policy no longer works on the soft power that once was its great strength, but on strictly military power. And I sense just a smaller countries wanting to back away from being dragged into that. U.S. is trying to do that even in Europe against China. I don't think it's going to work, but then I'm not sure where the Europeans are going to go. But the Europeans have nowhere to go if the U.S. is not close in there. I'd suggest that they think about joining BRICS.
Even if China did nothing in terms of the foreign policy, just sitting and watching the United States doing all the things, all this chaos, that could have been a win for them. That would have been a, yeah. Thank you so much, David and Graham, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Nima. Thank you, Graham.
Take care.
Thank you. My pleasure. Enjoyed it. Take care.
Take care.
Bye.